I want to talk to you this morning about faith. And I'm going to start with a story about a college student, and he was doing the required classes that they make everyone take, and one of those classes is speech. And he was assigned to give a speech to convince the class of something. And so he started out and he began to give his speech, and he was speaking about the law of the pendulum. Now, if you're not familiar, the law of the pendulum is if you take a pendulum, you know, picture the big sphere at the end of a long cable, and you swing it to one side and release it, it never will go higher than it was when you released it. Each time it comes back just a little bit less than it started. And so he taught the theory of this. He explained why this was the case and went through everything. And then he said, now, to finish up, I've got a demonstration. And he took a child's top at the end of a string and stuck it right above the blackboard and held it up and put a mark where he released it, and it swung across. And then it came back, and he marked where it was next time. And each time he did this, the marks were going down and down and down until finally it stopped at the bottom. And he said, now to wrap this up, how many of you believe the law of the pendulum? And every hand in the room went up. And he looked at the professor. He said, do you believe in the law of the pendulum? And the professor said, yes, I do. He said, okay, I have one final thing. Professor, if you would come over here. And he sat him in a chair against the cement block wall of the classroom. And he had taken 250 pounds of weight and suspended it from several strands of parachute cord. And he brought it up to about an inch from the professor's nose. And he said, now I'm going to ask you one more time. Do you believe the law of the pendulum? And at this point, the professor's upper lip is beginning to sweat a little bit, and he's trembling just a little bit, and he a little less confidently says, yes, I believe. And the student releases the weight. And it swings its arc out and momentarily comes to a stop at the other side, and then it begins to reverse direction. And just about that time, the professor dives out of his chair. And the student asks the class, does he really believe? And the answer is no, he doesn't. He doesn't really believe. When it came down to it, when it mattered, when he was facing 250 pounds of weight coming at his face, he bailed. It was more than he could take. He didn't believe, at least not that much. We're going to talk about faith this morning, this idea of believing. And if you've got your Bible, we're in Mark chapter 5, where we left off last week. Now, last week we went through Jesus and talked about Jesus having power and authority over a couple of different things. Now, the first one was he had power and authority over the weather, and we read about him calming the storm. Then he had power and authority over the supernatural, over the demons. The man was demon-possessed, and he cast the demons out. If you weren't here, I encourage you to go back and read through those this week. The two stories last week and the two that we're going to talk about this morning, the four of them really go together into a unit, but it was more than we could cover in 1 week, and so we split it up. And so we're going to see the second two this morning, and the second two, the third one, if you will, is that Jesus has the authority over sickness or disease or illness or health. And then finally, Jesus has authority over death itself. Now, this passage is another one of those Mark sandwiches that we've talked about before, where Mark takes a story, cuts it in half, splits the two pieces apart, and then puts another story in the middle of it. And so we're going to go through two stories, but it's kind of going to come as two halves of one, wrapped around the one in the center. And often the focus is on the one in the center. But Mark chapter 5, starting in verse 21, we read this. And when Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered about him, and he was beside the sea. Then came one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name, and seeing him, he fell at his feet and implored him earnestly, saying, my little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be well and live. And he went with him. This is the first part of our sandwich, and we learn a couple different things here. First, we're talking about this man, Jairus. We learn that he's the leader in the synagogue. Now, the synagogue was something that the Jewish people had started. The Jewish people were commanded by God to worship God at the tabernacle and then later the temple. As God gave them the land and they spread out throughout the land, they were commanded three times a year to travel to the temple to offer sacrifices, to celebrate, to worship God there. Well, when the people of Israel were removed by the land because they had failed to obey God, they were taken into captivity, and while in captivity, they were unable to go to the temple and worship God. And so they established the synagogues, which were places where they would go and they could hear God's word read to them. They could learn God's law, God's words. It gave them the opportunity to learn it so that they could teach it to the next generations. And so for hundreds of years while they're in captivity, that's what they did. When they eventually came back to the land, they continued with the synagogues because, again, many of them could only make it to Jerusalem a few times a year to worship God. And so the synagogues were spread all over the place, and in each town you could go to the synagogue, and there you could learn the things of God. And so the leader of the synagogue was one who had some authority, some responsibility in that structure. He wouldn't have been the only one that would speak, but he was the one that perhaps was in charge of maybe taking care of the building. Maybe his responsibilities included arranging who was going to teach what week on the Sabbath. Maybe he orchestrated that if this synagogue had copies of certain Old Testament books of the Bible, and another synagogue in another city had other ones, that maybe they would swap for a time so that they could hear the whole counsel of God. Or maybe he was responsible for purchasing. But he had a leadership role in the synagogue. And we also learn that his daughter is sick. If you've raised kids, especially daughters, you can imagine what it would be like to be a father and have your daughter be sick and be put in a position of not knowing what's going to happen. Is she going to get better or not? Is she going to die? And so this man, this leader in the synagogue, is at the point of not knowing if his daughter's going to survive this illness that she has. And he comes to Jesus and asks for him to lay hands on her. Now, as a leader in the synagogue, the religious leaders of Israel, most of them from Jerusalem, were not fans of Jesus by this point. They didn't like what he taught. They didn't like how he carried himself. They didn't like that he didn't keep all of their rules in addition to the rules of the scriptures. We already read they're beginning to plot and plan how they're going to deal with this problem they call Jesus. And so for this guy, this religious leader, to come to Jesus and look for a solution to his problem, for his daughter's life is in the balance, to come to Jesus, it kind of implies that he's got nowhere else to turn. Nowhere else to turn. We might say he's at the point of sitting in the chair and the pendulum is swinging back. He has nowhere else to turn. And so he comes to Jesus. And now we get to the second story, the break in the first one of this sandwich. The rest of verse 24, and a great crowd followed him and thronged about him. And there was a woman who had had a discharge of blood for 12 years. And who had suffered much under many physicians and had spent all that she had and was no better, but rather grew worse. She had heard the reports about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his garment. For she said, if I touch even his garments, I will be made well. And immediately the flow of blood dried up and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. And Jesus, perceiving in himself that power had gone out from him, immediately turned about in the crowd and said, who touched my garments? And his disciples said to him, you see the crowd pressing around you, and yet you say, who touched me? And he looked around to see who had done it, but the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease. We have this story of this woman. She's had this problem for 12 years. 12 years. The problem is she's been bleeding. And in our culture, if you've got something physical, some illness or disease that you're struggling with, and you struggle for 12 years, that's a long time. What were you doing 12 years ago? It would have been 2013. In our family, we were waiting for Grace to be born 12 years ago. The hit movie that year was Frozen. I'll let you guys go look up what else was going on 12 years ago. But do you remember where you were 12 years ago? Many of you were worshiping in different places. Many of you lived in different houses. Some of you in the last 12 years have gotten married. Some of you have had kids. There's been a lot of change in 12 years, is there not? And for that long, this woman has suffered with this problem. You can imagine the exhaustion she must have felt to be sick for that long. Not only that, but we know she's losing blood, and so there's questions of, was she in pain throughout all of this? Was she exhausted or tired because she was anemic from all of the blood loss? And then there's the practical side of dealing with this. And then perhaps most significant for this woman, there's the social side. See, in Jewish culture, a woman during a certain period of the month was unclean. And a person in Jewish culture who's unclean, they're unable to go to the temple and worship God directly. Everything that they touch becomes unclean and is considered contaminated. And so no one would come to her house, you can imagine. She would struggle to go out in public. She wasn't to touch anyone or have contact with anyone. She couldn't touch things that other people were going to touch. And so for 12 years, she was an outsider. And she couldn't participate in the life of her community. It says for 12 years, verse 26, she had suffered much under many physicians and had spent all that she had and was no better, but rather grew worse. I think that should be in every doctor's office waiting room on the wall. Maybe you've experienced that. Or maybe it should be over the employee entrance of the hospital. They've tried everything. There's nothing else they can do. She's spent all of her money going to this doctor and that one, to this specialist and that one. And all she's done is spent all of her money, and she's worse for the wear. She has no place else to turn. And she hears about Jesus. And she says to herself, if I could just touch the corner of his robe, maybe I would be healed. She's no doubt heard the stories of how he's healed other people. And so she gathers up her courage and ventures out into the street. She goes to where she's heard he is and finds the crowd there. And even though she's not supposed to touch anyone or come in contact with anyone, and the crowd is pressing around him, and if you've been in a big crowd that's moving in a direction, you know what it's like to try to make your way through the people in any way, shape, or form other than to just go with the flow. Yet this woman works her way through the crowd until she comes up behind him and touches the corner of his garment. And immediately she knows she's been healed. She can feel it. You ever had something go on in your body, whether there's pressure or something's not right? Several years ago, I was outside, and the dog, I was holding her by her collar to take her in the house, and she wrenched, and I twisted to catch her. I had a bunch of stuff in my hands. And my back kind of did one of these, and it wouldn't go back. For 2 days, I walked around like that. And finally, somebody said, you need to go see my cousin. He's a chiropractor. I walked in like this and walked out like that. Instantly, I knew it was fixed. That's what this woman experienced. instantly. Her problem was fixed. And she thinks, it's done. My problem is solved. And suddenly Jesus, right in front of her, stops. What do you think is going through her head at this point? Uh-oh. This was a covert operation. She was going to get in, touch the robe, and withdraw. And just as she's about to fade back into the crowd, he stops and turns around and says, "Who touched me? Who touched me?" And we suddenly see a contrast here between the woman and the disciples. What's their response? "What do you mean, who touched you? People are pressing around you from all directions." "Who didn't touch you?" would be a better question. The paraphrase of this would be, "Silly Jesus, what do you mean, who touched you?" He says, "No, I felt the power leave me. Who touched me?" What does it say? She told him the whole truth. The whole truth. "Well, Jesus, I've had this problem for 12 years. I'm not supposed to be in this crowd. I shouldn't have touched you at all. But I thought maybe, just maybe, if I touched the corner of your robe, I would be healed, and I did, and I was." What's Jesus' response? "Your faith has made you well." A couple of stories ago, when they were in the boat and they woke Jesus up, what does he say to the disciples? "Don't you have any faith? Don't you have any faith?" And then here we see this woman who had faith. At a seminary professor who talks about this passage, and she says, this is what I refer to as cat theology. Let me explain. She was a dog person, and her husband was a cat person, and for years they had debated which was better, and so for years they didn't have any pets. And finally, one year on his birthday, she broke down and in a moment of weakness said, "You can go get a cat." And without hesitating, he went and got a cat for fear she would change her mind. And about the next week, they have this little kitten, and she is tasked with taking the kitten to the vet to get shots. And so she gets the kitten and puts it in the car, gets in the car and starts driving to the vet. Now, she's never had a cat. She knows not much about cats. And one of the things she didn't know was that you put the cat in the cat carrier to take it to the vet. So she's driving along, and this kitten is all over her, the inside of her car. And eventually, it's under the seat, and she can hear it down there moving around, and she just continues to drive. And pretty soon, it's quiet for a short time, and then she feels claws in the top of her head. The cat had crawled up the back of the seat and jumped onto her head and was holding on. So she said, "I took the kitten and I pulled it off of my head and put it on the seat beside me and began to pet the cat with one hand while I continued to drive with the other hand." In an effort to calm the kitten down, she began to talk to it about the benefits of going to the vet and how this was going to prevent diseases and there were going to be things that the cat wouldn't have to worry about as a result of this visit, and that the needle might hurt a little bit, but it was for its greater good, and it should accept that. And she says, and then it dawns on me, as I'm talking to this kitten, that this is not unlike my relationship with God. Sometimes God puts us in a place, and he does it, and we don't understand why. And we experience things like illness or death or trying times or financial difficulties or whatever it is that you're going through. And we don't understand it, and we're asking God, "God, why are you doing this, and why me, and why now? And God, don't you love me? Don't you care about me? Couldn't you fix this? Couldn't you make this pain go away?" It's us sitting in the chair with our head against the cement block wall, and the pendulum is swinging at us. And it's almost as if God is saying, look, I could try to explain this to you, but you won't understand. And so you need to trust me. You need to trust that I, the God who can control nature and the natural world, I, the God that can control the supernatural world and even demons, I, the God who can control health and even death, I care about you. I've got you. You have nothing to worry about. Trust me. Have faith. Is that where you're at this morning? Do you trust? Do you have faith? Do you believe that the God who's in control of all of these things cares about you and wants what's best for you? But how often do you and I want to be comfortable or to not feel pain or to not experience heartache or hardship? And God's saying, but what's best for you is to go through this so that your faith grows. Now we get to the other half of the story. What about Jairus and his daughter? Verse 35, while he was still speaking, there came from the ruler's house some who said, your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further? But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the ruler of the synagogue, do not fear, only believe. And he allowed no one to follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. They came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue, and Jesus saw the commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. And when he had entered, he said to them, why are you making a commotion and weeping? The child is not dead, but sleeping. And they laughed at him, but he put them all outside and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him and went in where the child was. Taking her by the hand, he said to her, Talitha kumi, which means, little girl, I say to you, arise. And immediately the girl got up and began walking, for she was 12 years of age. And they were immediately overcome with amazement. And he strictly charged them that no one should know this and told them to give her something to eat. The dad of the little girl. He's sitting in the chair with his head against the wall. And that weight is flying at his face. And just about the time it passes center and has maximum speed is, your daughter has died. Don't bother the teacher anymore. What's the response going to be? And Jesus looks at him and says, believe. Believe. This is a faith moment. Have faith. And so he takes Peter, James, and John, and the dad, and they go back to the house. And they get there, and the mourners are already there, wailing and weeping outside. In their culture, the louder the mourning, the longer the mourning went, the more important the person or the family was. This was part of the funeral ritual, if you will. And they were already there. They had no doubt been called before she died, maybe. They've seen many, many dead people. They've experienced death over and over and over. It's what they do for a living. And they're in the house and they see the child's body on the bed. They know she's dead. And so they begin the mourning process to let everyone in town know that she's passed away. And we've got another contrast here. We've got the dad who had faith to go and get Jesus. The dad who is no doubt antsy as Jesus is dealing with the woman who's been bleeding for 12 years. The dad who hears the news that his daughter has died. And Jesus says, come on, let's go, believe. And you contrast that with the crowd standing outside, laughing. And so they go into the house, and Jesus sends everyone out of the house except for the mom and the dad and Peter, James, and John. And he takes the child by the hand, and he tells her to get up, and she gets up. And we learn she's 12 years old. She's the same age as the length of time the woman has had the problem. And we learn that not only does Jesus have power and authority over sickness and disease and health, but also over death itself as he raises this little girl from the dead. So the question is, can you trust him or not? Can you trust him or not? We talk about disciples and followers of Jesus. Those who follow Jesus, they come to a point of recognizing the plight of humanity in this world. That all of us have rebelled against God. The Bible calls that sin, and it says that everyone who's sinned, and that's everyone, is guilty of sin. They deserve punishment. They deserve to die. And there's nothing we can do about that. But God says, let me rescue you. And so he sends his one and only son, Jesus, who lives a perfect life and demonstrates not only is he fully God, but he's also fully man. He says, I will willingly take your place. That punishment you deserve, I will take it in your place. It'll be my gift to you. All you have to do is receive it by faith. There's nothing you can do about your spiritual position before God. You've messed up. The pendulum is swinging towards you. What are you going to do? You accept it by faith. And then we go through life as followers of Jesus, and over, he asks us to trust him. And we get in those difficult situations, and we sometimes wonder, can I trust or not? And we've got his word here so that we can get to know him. So that we can learn that he's more powerful than whatever it is that you or I are facing. And that we can trust him. And because we've seen him be faithful over and over and over to his people for generations, we can be confident that we too can trust him. And we don't have to understand all the reasons why we can't comprehend sometimes what he's doing or why he's doing it. But he says, you can trust me. Have faith. Have faith. And what happens if we lack faith? Look at the next few verses, chapter 6, verse 1. He went away from there and came to his hometown, and his disciples followed him. And on the Sabbath, he began to teach in the synagogue. And many who heard him were astonished, saying, where did this man get these things? What is the wisdom given to him? How are such mighty works done by his hands? Is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary, and the brother of James and Joses and Judas and Simon? Are not his sisters here with us? And they took offense at him. And Jesus said to them, a prophet is not without honor except in his hometown and among his relatives and in his own household. And he could do no mighty work there except that he laid hands on a few sick people and healed them. And he marveled because of their unbelief. And he went about among the villages teaching. Jesus travels to his own hometown. And on the Sabbath, he goes into the synagogue to teach the people there the things of God. And as he's there teaching, the people are amazed at the way he teaches. How is he this good of a teacher? Where did he get this wisdom? How does he understand these things? This guy never followed one of the famous rabbis. He never went to school or to seminary. Yet he teaches amazing things. And he heals people. He has power. Where did this come from? We know this guy. He grew up down the street. Our kids work with his kids. They're intermarried. We know his sisters. We know his mom. We watched them all grow up together. And the carpenter boy that we knew is now teaching. How'd this happen? And it says the people in his hometown lacked faith. They didn't believe. And the result of that was, and again, Jesus is all powerful, but Jesus doesn't go around forcing himself on the people. And so when he encounters people who lack faith, people who don't believe, he doesn't force himself on them. In the same way as his followers, he calls us to go and take the good news of him to the world around us. In the next section, we're going to see him sending his disciples out to do ministry. The same way he sends you and I to do ministry. But what happens if we lack the faith? What happens to you and I in our ministry for Jesus is if every time that pendulum swings, we're diving out of the chair to get out of the way? We send a message to the people around us that maybe he's not dependable. And it begins to get in the way, and it begins to hinder ministry. And it becomes a problem. So where are you with this morning? Are you a person of faith? Are you living by faith? Are you willing to trust? When life doesn't go your way, do the people around you see panic and someone jumping out of the chair looking for cover? Or do they see someone who's willing to sit and trust that God has what your best interest in mind? That maybe he's going to use you in a way that you didn't anticipate, but you're willing to trust and see what he does. Because ultimately, that's what we're called to do. And if we're going to serve and be effective in ministry and sharing the good news of Jesus, we need to be willing to live by faith. Live by faith. Are you doing that this morning? Or where in your life do you need to grow that faith a little bit? Or say, God, I'm giving this to you. I'm depending on you. I'm trusting in you. It's not about me or up to me, but it's up to you. And so I submit to what you're putting me through. That's a completely different posture than someone jumping out of the chair every time that pendulum moves. Let's close in a word of prayer. Father God, we come before you as your people. Father, my prayer is that we would have faith, that as we go through this life, we would demonstrate that we believe your son was who he claimed he was, and that you are the all-powerful God that we serve, and that we can have complete confidence in you, not just for our life here, but also for our eternal destiny. So, Father, my prayer is that we would live like we're yours, that people around us would see our faith and see it come alive, and that the result would be that we would impact the world around us for your kingdom. It's in your son's name that we pray. Amen.